Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be talking to Elena Zachary and Jonathan Richards about the new play, Dear Liar. I'd like now to welcome to the program Sandy Buffett. She is Executive Director of Conservation Voters New Mexico. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. This is becoming an annual tradition for us.
It is indeed, right at the beginning of the legislative session, a 60-day session this year. So, first of all, what is Conservation Voters New Mexico?
So, CVNM works to build the political voice for conservation around the state. And we do that in three unique ways. First, Conservation Voters works to elect pro-environment champions and to defeat those who vote against our environment. Next, we advocate at the legislature on key bills and measures that either protect or seek to strip away our existing protections that protect the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the land, and those things that we love most about New Mexico. And third, we keep score. And by that, I mean we do an annual legislative scorecard so New Mexicans can know whether their environmental values are being represented at the Roundhouse or not.
So in the last years, the last 8 years, Bill Richardson has been governor of New Mexico. We've had both a Democratic governor and a Democratic legislature, more or less. What have been the results for the environment of New Mexico for environmental protection?
Well, let me say first that we are a nonpartisan organization. We have done bipartisan endorsements in the past. Certainly the last 8 years, we had a friend of conservation in the governor's office, and we got a lot accomplished. We set up protection. We set up funding mechanisms for land conservation. We made great strides in protecting our groundwater, holding accountable polluters, and just making, ensuring that New Mexico is poised for a 21st century economy by building the jobs of the future that can't be outsourced, and those are clean energy jobs. So we are really in a great place right now for an economic recovery, to have clean energy jobs and to protect what we love about New Mexico. But it means that a lot is at stake.
So as we look at the beginning of the session, the composition of the legislature has changed, and that now there is a Republican governor who so far does not look like a friend of the environment or conservation.
Well, on the legislative side, the partisanship tightened up in the House. We're now at 37 Democrats, 33 Republicans. And the Senate had no seats up last November 2nd, so it remains, I believe, at 28-14. 28 Democrats, 14 Republicans, although one of those seats is Diana Duran's, and that's going to be appointed any moment now. But we lost, unfortunately, several conservation-minded champions in the State House on November 2nd. I believe they were caught up in the tide of voter anger that had very little to do with conservation policy, but had more to do with an anger against incumbents. And so we lost six of our folks that were voting 100% of the time pro-environment. So the legislature, especially the House, is going to have a lot of new faces for us. And then, of course, we have a new governor, Governor Susana Martinez. And from what I hear of the first year of any new governor is that there is a honeymoon period between the legislature and the governor. So we'll be watching to see what that means.
What does that mean?
That there's a lot of cooperation and goodwill towards whatever the governor's agenda is. There was a recent article where Governor Richardson said that was his best session as well, that he accomplished a lot. So we'll see how this session goes for our new governor.
Well, that could be, if I may say so, dangerous for the air, land, and water and health of our citizens if her agenda is to undo all of the great legislation that has protected the environment in the last 8 years.
Right, and that is why we will be vigilant at the legislature every day and every night until they adjourn towards the end of March. While I still have a positive attitude that we can find areas in common, and once she hears from New Mexicans that these are priorities to protect air, land, and water, I'm optimistic that those protections will remain in place. But it's critical for New Mexicans to be vocal about defending what we have in place that protects our health and our environment.
So let's talk specifically about what we're looking at. What are some of the, I think this year it's not so much that there are proactive bills that pro-environmental people are hoping to get passed, but they're just trying to do damage control and hope that, and try to see to it that there are not rollbacks and repeals of existing environmental legislation.
Exactly.
And that is
a shift for us, because we, in the past few years, have had a very aggressive agenda of moving the bar further out on environmental protections. And this year, we are in defense mode, if you will.
Right.
I just did want to share with your listeners that, in fact, the New Mexico State Constitution does provide for protecting our environment. I wanted to read it.
Yes, please do.
Article 20, Section 21, which was adopted in 1971, right after the Earth Day era. The protection of the state's beautiful and healthful environment is of fundamental importance to the public interest, health, safety, and the general welfare. The legislature shall provide for control of pollution and control of despoilment of the air, water, and other natural resources of the state. So we will be ensuring that the new members of the legislature are aware that that provision is in there.
And what does that mean? I mean, constitutionally, the state constitution, can the state be sued if it violates its own provision of the Constitution?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, we are seeing a lot of legal action in the last few days on the environment, because there's a lot of vagueness. For example, we saw the executive order from Governor Martinez that suspended rules, pending rules, and regulations.
Yes, which we've talked about on this program in great detail about the carbon cap, which was arrived at after many years of public hearings and so on.
And it makes me wonder, can you suspend or can you just go back on hundreds of hours of public testimony because the margins weren't aligned and the font wasn't selected for printing of the New Mexico Record? I mean, just by the stroke of a pen. Those all are great questions, and we will also be looking into whether things are unconstitutional while we're at the legislature.
What are some specific rollbacks that Conservation Voters New Mexico is looking at?
Well, we've already seen a bill pre-filed, Senate Bill 91, by Senator Clint Hardin, which in the short title refers to suspending rules, but we prefer to call it endearingly the Polluters Bill of Rights.
What does this bill say?
So it says that when this bill is passed and it has an emergency clause in it, which means it goes into effect immediately, that it seeks to suspend rules on the global warming proposals in very much a similar fashion of legislative approach that the executive order sought to suspend those rules by executive order.
So the carbon caps.
The carbon caps. That means, you know, that New Mexico will not take advantage of innovating and putting a price on carbon and thereby attracting investment in clean energy. So we will lose that opportunity to innovate. And
that is, I mean, this is one of the things, if I may just insert this right here, the idea that protecting extractive industries is worth the tens of millions of dollars of venture capital investment that would come into the state for solar and wind.
Yeah. I mean,
that's the trade-off you're looking at.
That's right. And after, California adopted carbon pollution reduction standards in 2008, it had a huge influx of venture capital into these new industries. So why wouldn't we want to seize some of those investment dollars here in New Mexico and create good clean energy jobs?
So basically, okay, so this Senate bill that you're talking about would do away with these rules that were just adopted.
It's sort of a kitchen sink approach. It suspends the prevailing wage and fringe benefit rates for workers working on state public works projects as well.
What does that mean?
Apparently, one of the commissions related to labor standards at the state level passed rules to provide for prevailing wage or a better standard for worker wages.
So basically, it would just say that you can pay workers the minimum wage who would have been better paid before,
and provides fringe benefit rates for if workers are going to work on publicly financed public works projects.
Oh, okay.
And then it attacks the Albuquerque Bernalillo County Air Quality Board, which set its own clean car fuel efficiency standards a few years ago. Now, on the one hand, I think that this is made obsolete anyways because Obama, the administration, has already adopted strong CAFE corporate average fuel efficiency standards for automobiles and trucks. So, what has me very concerned about that is a senator from Union County attacking via legislation the outcome of a county level rulemaking process. Bernalillo County's in this case, and people in Santa Fe County, I would think, would be very concerned about this sort of approach where the legislature is nullifying rules of adopted by a county,
such as Galisteo. There are issues of who has jurisdiction, who's allowed to do what. Mm-hmm. If the state can roll over municipal and county rules by the stroke of a pen, that concerns a lot of people who want local control.
Local control and autonomy, and of course Santa Fe and other counties have led the way in setting up ordinances for oil and gas drilling in Santa Fe County.
Right.
So that's worrisome. And then the bill, it says that rulemaking shall start from scratch, basically throwing out the door the hundreds of hours of public testimony on both sides. And everyone was represented in those public hearings around the state. And if the starting from scratch can't occur within 180 days, according to this bill, then it will be removed from the code entirely.
So that's the Senate bill, what was
91.
Number? Senate Bill 91, which you're calling the Polluters Bill of Rights. What do they call it?
Yeah, I fear it may not be the only bill we have to call that, but that's the first one we've seen.
Okay, what other bills are you looking at?
Well, we've also seen Senate Joint Resolution 3 by Senator Stephen Neville, which sounds a little wonky, but I'll explain why it's critical to the environment. It seeks to have a constitutional amendment put on the ballot, and it would probably be put on the 2012 New Mexico ballot, which seeks to allow the legislature to overturn any rule by a state agency by a 2/3 vote in each chamber. And this really raises issues of separation of power, but in the implementation, the potential implementation of this would be, I believe, aimed at the environmental rules that we have in place.
So give me an example of how that would work. Just a hypothetical example.
Well, currently how it works is that any affected party, if they are unhappy with the outcome of rulemaking, they can seek legal relief through the judiciary by suing and to have the rules nullified. But what this does is it transfers the authority from the judicial branch and the authority of the executive branch to be promulgating rules back to the legislature to override them.
So if somebody wanted to sue over some rule, they no longer could?
No, they still could, but it might be cheaper and more expedient to get a legislature that was sympathetic to, say, an industry to just override the rule. And there are, the legislature, through enabling acts, gives the authority to these agencies to promulgate rules. And I don't know if you've been over to the state capitol during a session on a 60-day or a 30-day. This is a citizen legislature. They have thousands of bills already. Most of them, except leadership, do not have professional staff to analyze these bills. They're very dependent then on lobbyists to say this is what this bill does.
And on citizen input.
So you already have a legislature stretched really thin that can barely keep up with the thousands of bills that come before it in 30 days or 60 days. Now this is saying we're also going to vest the legislature the authority to override by 2/3 any rule that might have taken 100 hours by the commission or by the board that heard the testimony, the public testimony. That's why those commissions are in place.
Okay, so you let's think of an actual hypothetical example. Let's say you have a rule that prevents the gas industry from dumping their waste into the school water water
right.
well.
Right.
So little children don't have to drink waste poison gas solids.
And that rule would have been set up hypothetically.
And that rule
by
was
a
set up by a commission, and they heard
testimony
and all the little kids who got sick and all that. Okay.
Technical expertise on both sides, and then they have to, some of those commissions have to sign that they've read all the documents. I mean, it takes a lot.
It's a process, and it's a serious process that is designed to work in a way that's fair and just. Okay, so
right.
If this bill that you're talking about, what's it called?
Senate Joint Resolution 3.
Okay, if that joint resolution were passed,
to the voters. It would go onto the ballot for voters to decide if they wanted to grant the legislature this new authority.
And so if the legislature then had that new authority, then lobbyists from the gas industry could swarm into the legislature and say, no, these things actually taste like Kool-Aid, and they're really good for children. And if 2/3 in each chamber believed them,
then the rule, if there was 2/3 vote on both sides, then the rule would be nullified.
Okay.
So we oppose this.
Ladies and gentlemen.
But there are some other potential rollbacks or potential attacks on our existing safeguards and protections that we expect to see, and I'd like to highlight a few of those.
Okay.
The PIT rule.
Yes.
Now, this phrase has been bantered about a lot, especially on the campaign trail, and we heard lots of candidates say they want to overturn the PIT rule, and I would gamble some of them don't even know what it does. But let me
see if I can get this right. It means lining toxic waste pits with a tarp so that the toxic waste doesn't go into the groundwater.
So in the production of oil and gas, there are byproducts of produced water which have been put into a pit in the ground. And before the PIT rules were in place, there were, according to the State Energy Department, 421 cases self-reported by industry. So 421 known cases of groundwater contamination. Since the PIT rules have been in place, there have been zero. But so it says
that might indicate that it works.
It's working, yeah. Okay. So it says line the pit because there are several potential chemicals that could be in this water, and it's very briny, and it could, it's just sort of like a sludge. The former energy secretary described it as, imagine like taking coffee grounds and sludge and some oil, and then throwing it all in a big pit and oftentimes it's on somebody else's private property because of the split estate issues we have in New Mexico. So then it also says, you know, we're going to keep an inventory of where all these pits are, because the state didn't have a grasp up until then of, you know, I think there's been 90,000 rigs in the last century in New Mexico, and almost all of them have an associated pit. But we don't know, you know, because then they're covered up at the end of the life of the rig. So the pit rules do establish pit closure procedures.
Right.
It just says, you know, if you're going to have these sorts of potentially toxic chemicals near groundwater, that we want to protect the groundwater. 9 out of 10 New Mexicans depend on groundwater as our source of drinking water. So
that seems so eminently rational.
Reasonable, doesn't it? Common sense. It was an 18-month process to develop the rules. There were 19 days of hearings from all sides. All sides were represented and testified. And what I find interesting is that in recent months we've heard claims that this is hurting New Mexico oil and gas production. And, it, you know, other claims have been it's driving production out of the state. But I was just looking up the...
Like they don't have rules like this in other states?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because I just saw an article in the Aspen Times of Colorado, December 31st, where the Colorado Oil and Gas Association said that Colorado now has the toughest oil and gas regulations in the country, but that we can live with them. So Colorado is figuring out a way to do it, that they prefer just the certainty of existing regulations rather than throwing the whole process up into the air again.
Right.
So if Colorado can do it, and they proclaim that those are the toughest in the country, then I think New Mexico can do it too. You know, we used to joke with our colleagues in Colorado that... our oil and gas folks were saying that jobs are being driven to Colorado, and they were hearing in Colorado testimony that jobs were being driven to New Mexico.
Oh,
so we said they could wave at each other on the return pass. But I just looked up this morning what's called the Baker Hughes rig count. This is an industry point of data that industry uses to measure whether production is up or down, and it counts the rigs, our new rigs. So I believe that as of January, New Mexico Baker Hughes rig count is at 72, which is up substantially from when right before the pit rules went into place.
So there's actually more rigs since the pit rule went into place than before.
Than right before and right during the implementation when what was happening in the world was a change in the global commodity price of crude. That is what was driving, in that period of time, a decrease.
Right, not the pit rule.
Yeah, so now that we see that New Mexico is up at the same time last week that Wyoming is down, I believe that the industry's own data, such as Baker Hughes, shows that production is up.
So why
and
go ahead.
Water is protected. That's a win-win.
Production is up. Water is protected. So what's the problem?
That's a great question. And I think that legislators are going to have to consider these things. I mean,
and hear from their constituents,
and hear
which
from
means
their constituents.
All of you out there in radio land, ladies mm-hmm. and gentlemen, we're talking to Sandy Buffett, Executive Director of Conservation Voters New Mexico. There is another set of regulations that we've talked about this in the past on this show, dairy regulations,
right,
which have a certain physical similarity to pit rule regulations.
Again,
namely,
it's groundwater protection.
It's groundwater protection, and dairies produce a very large amount of, believe it or not, cow manure,
yeah.
Which can in that quantities be very toxic. And so
our friends at Amigos Bravos tell us that dairy cows in Chavez County alone produce enough waste, as the same amount of waste as the human populations of Los Angeles and Philadelphia combined. And something I just learned recently was that New Mexico...
How can that be?
Well, you know, have you driven and seen some of those dairies that have thousands of cows for the dairy industry in a relatively tight quarters. And then, of course, they produce waste that has to go somewhere. I was surprised to learn New Mexico now has the largest dairy herds in the nation. This is a phenomenon, I believe, that's just occurred over the last decade. And that we have, according to the Water Quality Bureau of New Mexico, in testimony, 57% of the dairies in our state have polluted groundwater. There's a connection to contamination adjacent to these dairies. So it's very concerning, but it's also something that we can fix. And what's interesting is that the industry itself and the legislature pushed for these rules to be promulgated.
Together.
Yeah. There was a bill a few years ago, SB 206, directed by the legislature for the Water Quality Control Commission to develop rules. And so, again, my understanding is that these basically say, let's line these manure ponds.
So it's essentially lining pits again. We're back to lining pits.
You know, you wouldn't allow your neighbor just to come dump something in your yard.
You know what it's like? It's like changing your own oil and then having to put the oil not in your driveway
not
or down
your driveway.
The drain.
That's right. I mean, I think you can be fined for that.
You can be fined for that.
So I think that if we can get to a place where industry and the conservation community and communities that are really the ones crying out for these common sense safeguards, that if we can get to a point where, okay, we've gotten these rules in place that have been hashed out on both sides. Neither side probably thinks they're great or what they were seeking, but they're a compromise. And then we can allow industry to have certainty, which is really what they say they want, just certainty in the regulation.
Right.
Code.
This is it. It's not going to change next year and the year after and the year after. But, right. but the thing is, I'm not sure we can do the math on the radio here, but let's just talk in principle about the math. So, you have, let's say it costs X amount of money, let's say it costs $200,000 to line a pit, and you line a pit. How much would it cost to
and
clean up?
And I don't believe
up?
It costs nearly that amount,
all right, just
in terms
making,
of the oil
making,
and gas.
Right, making yeah. it up. Let's say it costs $100,000, nice round number base, costs $100,000 to line a pit. How much would it cost to clean up a toxic site? A, and how much would it cost to treat the leukemia in the child that gets cancer from the toxic waste that went into his or her groundwater?
Which is very hard to prove and almost never proven those links
right.
by
but,
community
but you have
members, but
cancer clusters in children in places around toxic sites all over the country.
And asthma rates. And well, what it's really a philosophy is should taxpayers shoulder the burden of cleaning up industry's mess after the fact? Or should we, as Benjamin Franklin said, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Let's prevent the pollution in the first place, and then we save taxpayers from having to come in and bail out the situation.
Well, not only that, I mean, if you actually just look at it purely on a kind of balance sheet, the extra profit that the oil and gas industry or whatever dairy, whatever industry makes, some of it will actually result in increased revenues. But are those increased revenues enough to pay for the mess? Or does it actually have to come out of my and your income tax?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and it's especially on oil and gas, I don't have access to their balance sheet, so I don't know,
right.
what the true costs are. But we do hear from several of the more responsible companies that it's just become a cost of doing business, and that they've figured out a way to do it and still profit and still increase their production.
There are a couple of other problems or issues that are coming up. One of them is the proposed reduction on the budget of the Environment Department.
Right. Now, the Environment
Department,
budgets,
which is designed to protect the environment.
Yeah. The proposed budget from Governor Martinez came out a few days ago, and these things are hundreds of pages. And it's, you often have to, you know, read between the lines. But the things that jumped out at me were that the average cut across the board is I believe, 5%. Yet the New Mexico Environment Department under Martinez's general fund proposal was a negative 21% change.
Okay.
So just really a disproportionate reduction of the Environment Department resources compared to other departments. And, I mean, their job is to protect human health and safety. So by doing that, you slash enforcement capacity. The Environmental Health Division took a big cut. And one thing of note is that proposal has a 100% elimination of general fund money to Water and Wastewater Division, which my understanding was set up to provide a one-stop shop to rural communities that want to upgrade their sewer system or delivery of water, and to find the funds and grants and loans so that you can bring rural communities just into the 20th century of water delivery and sewer systems. And the elimination of that division is very concerning for rural folks. And then the Energy Minerals Department, while having less of a cut than Environment Department, still had about 6% and 6% cut. And what worries me there is that it could be really hard to keep some of our state parks open with that deep of a cut. And then, of course, there's been no serious discussion of revenue enhancements.
Right.
On the other side of the balance sheet. So we think 21% is disproportionate and punitive.
So in other words, one half of 1% income tax increase or other kinds of taxation, which would make up for these losses.
Well, my understanding is that just the fees that are, or the fines that are imposed on the oil and gas industry for pollution haven't been adjusted since the 1930s.
Oh my goodness.
That's just, those sorts of things are not even being discussed by policymakers as to how to raise revenue. In the whole film industry discussion, it's been very curious how those incentives seem on the chopping block, but there's no willingness to discuss the $400 million in subsidies to the fossil fuel industries.
Right. Which are just industry incentives, essentially.
And those are, one would consider, mature industries or even last century's industries.
Right.
Why does the government still need to incentivize that?
Mature and perhaps aging and getting old industries.
Well, the Nation, I just saw today, has a great article called Green Energy Opponents Are the Real Job Killers. And it asserts that continuing to rely or incentivize fossil fuels will actually lead to our economic decline.
Well, I think that was the argument behind, in this whole carbon cap discussion, trying to encourage renewable energies like solar. It's not like we don't have sun in the state of New Mexico to locate and do their thing here. We've got sun and open land, and those are long-lasting industries, and the sun doesn't get used up.
Right. And we also had a report out of Sandia Labs in May 2010, recently, you know, that bastion of liberalism tree-hugging, our national
Sandia
Labs. I'm joking.
Yeah, I know.
But they had a report. The title was Executive Summary of Assessing the Near-Term Risk of Climate Uncertainty, that concluded that policymakers that fail to seriously address climate change and the resulting disruption put our economy at risk. And so that is the message that we will be ensuring that the legislature and Governor Martinez hears.
So what is the role of citizens who are concerned about the environment in making a difference during the next 60 days?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a huge role, and in fact, it's all of our responsibility, shared responsibility, to ensure that we get heard. Now, in your listenership, we have several legislators who are consistent environmental champions. So in their case, actually, you know, sometimes they only hear from constituents when something is wrong. I encourage voters to also call their elected officials and praise them when they do the right thing to protect the environment.
Right.
'Cause you know, they need to hear from their constituents on what the what constituents appreciate as much as what they are concerned about.
So is it the kind of situation where, okay, here we are talking to people in the area from Albuquerque to Taos, more or less, mm-hmm. on KSFR, and their legislators already are scoring high on your
many of them, not
scorecard.
You can go to our website and see the scorecard, and you can
right.
find out the actual score of your legislator.
Right, good. CVNM.org. but what about people in other parts of the state? I mean, they must, on some level, be concerned about their own health and safety.
Well, that's, of course. That is a role we play in ensuring that communities that are represented by powerful legislators on committees, that before that committee vote, that those folks hear from us or hear in the press about upcoming votes that will affect their community. And so we do a lot of outreach. I would say actually most of our mobilization of voters to patch through live via a live phone call to their elected official is in the rural part of the state, because those are the areas represented by powerful legislators that are usually not with us. So that is how, you know, citizens can get involved. Of course, they can come up February 3rd. We are having a lobby day on the environment. And, if folks want to learn more about that, they can, call our office at 992-VOTE or 992-8683. How to get involved in that lobby day.
505-992-8683. Now, if you call, legislator whose district you're not in, is there any point in doing that?
I urge against that because for two reasons. One, that they oftentimes rural legislators, if they get a call from an urban area, they'll actually sends them in the opposite direction.
Right.
But also it drowns out the calls that they're actually getting from their constituents that may be on our side. So we do as much as we can to ensure that voices from the district are being heard. But of course, with the governor's office, every voter in the state has a equal voice there.
And is encouraged to call.
Yes, and that number is 476-2200. And you can certainly express the hope that our existing safeguards and protections that protect our communities remain in place.
Governor's Office, 505-476-2200. Sandy Buffett, anything else that you want to let people know about?
Well, you know, I hope to check in with you at a regular basis when we have some really quick-moving pieces of legislation and put out a call to action. So I'd love to come back again and let your listeners know about those opportunities.
Sure, why not?
Yeah. And then we'll be watching the appointments as well as they go through Senate confirmation. It's concerning to me to hear nominees for our key environmental agencies and energy agencies talking about regulatory overkill and skepticism on man-made climate change. So we'll be...
Yeah, on the one hand, you have our national laboratories and universities talking about the economic and health dangers of not facing climate change, and then you have people appointed to positions who are saying, there's no climate change.
Well, and even the U.S. Navy and the Pentagon now have have people tasked with mitigating and planning for climate change. I mean,
and climate change refugees.
Climate change refugees. I mean, you just have to watch the news now to see what's going on all over the world of all this flooding, just the disruption occurring. And then here in New Mexico, we see less snowpack. When we do get snow, it melts earlier. This affects our growing seasons. This affects our water supply. It affects the ability for us to be a healthy, thriving state and economy if we don't have enough water.
Sandy Buffett is Executive Director of Conservation Voters New Mexico. They can be found on the web at cvnm.org, and they can be called at 505-992-8683. Sandy, thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a few moments. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the program Elena Zachary and Jonathan Richards. They will be reading this coming Sunday, the 23rd of January at 4 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore from a play called Dear Liar. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, nice
Mary
to be
Shirley,
here.
It's a pleasure.
Good to have you back as always. Now, Dear Liar, it's a play based on the letters between George Bernard Shaw and Mrs. Patrick Campbell. Probably people know who George Bernard Shaw was. Who was Mrs. Patrick Campbell?
She
was the leading actress of her day in London, and a towering, scary, petulant woman.
And she was the actress for whom he wrote the character of Eliza Doolittle in Pygmalion.
Is that right?
Although she thought he had a little attitude making her be a Cockney girl. She takes great issue with that. To his delight.
And there's also the issue that at the time that she first played Eliza, she was right around 50, perhaps a little on the veteran side for the role, but it was a tremendous success. It was Mrs. Patrick Campbell as Eliza and Sir Herbert Beerbohm Tree, one of the great actors of the late 19th century, as Henry Higgins.
Now, what were these two to each other that they had such a long-standing correspondence? It's called Dear Liar, a Comedy of Letters, and it's taken from their actual correspondence, mm-hmm. edited into a play by Jerome Kilty.
Between 1899 and 1934, they wrote hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of letters.
That's a long time.
What they were to each other is, in fact, unknowable, because we don't know that there was ever the consummation of this obviously loving, literary, provocative, annoying friendship. They both had tremendous adulation for the spoken word, which is clear, and this wasn't the only actress with whom the eminent George Bernard Shaw had a correspondence. But certainly this was the most important.
And the other very well-known actress of her day was Ellen Terry, with whom he exchanged. Also a very literate and romantic series of letters. But this was probably the longest. Actually, the last letter is dated 1939, just on the eve of the war and just before she died. The thing about the way the relationship develops that's so fascinating in this play is that when it begins in 1899, she is the great actress of her day, and he is a known but not particularly celebrated drama critic and music critic. He is just beginning to find his feet as a playwright, but he hasn't had great successes yet. And the cusp on which the play and the relationship turns is the production, finally, in 1914 of Pygmalion, which finds her at the height of her fame and him reaching the height of his fame. And after that, he goes on to greater and greater success, and she begins a slow but inexorable decline.
He was married at the time. She was not. Though she got remarried, she was a widow, she got remarried during the process of their correspondence. And also, Apple Cart, which he wrote later, was allegedly written about her.
About her, mm-hmm. And because Edith Evans. Edith Evans played the character based on Mrs. Patrick Campbell in Shaw's The Apple Cart.
So what did they write to each other about?
Well, at one point, she says to him, I shall write you a love letter. And he says, a love letter? My God, when have you ever written me anything else? But the correspondence is, some of it's about business, some of it's about romance, some of it's about feelings of betrayal. There's a tremendously passionate and moving correspondence that has to do with the death of her son, who is killed in World War I, and as you would expect from Shaw, some just magnificently anti-war sentiments there. Then as it goes on and her career goes into decline, you get more of the sense of her growing desperation, the desperation of a woman whose eggs have all been in one basket, mm-hmm. and that basket is beginning to crumble.
She comes to this country to be in the talkies, and at one point she feels like she's reduced. They don't acknowledge her, but she still has her petulant diva-like attitude. But she writes to Shaw for money because she really, really needs financial support and assumes that he's been raking it in for all of his successes.
Which he denies, you know, probably, probably not entirely truthfully. But the thing about the play that makes it so wonderful is that it recaptures with two famous people, whether you remember Mrs. Patrick Campbell or not. She was, you know, the great actress of her day, and of course Shaw we know, and it recaptures a period at which people wrote wonderfully literate letters to each other, letters that were evocative and playful and fun and romantic and caustic and savage, but they were never anything less than wonderfully literate. They're just great to listen to.
There's even conversation in the letters about the publication of Same, which was achieved. It was achieved after their death.
Yes, so no wonder they were self-conscious about leaving out important details.
Well, she wants to publish the correspondence. He is outraged. You know, a gentleman does not kiss and tell kind of thing. And
but we don't even know if they kiss.
That's right.
We don't know if they kiss, but I mean metaphorically kiss and tell. There is the... finally, he grudgingly says he will edit them down and she can publish the edited, the expurgated versions that he gives her, and she is outraged at that, and there's this tug of war between the two of them. So then, of course, when he writes the apple cart about her, she says, "Oh, a gentleman doesn't kiss and tell, eh? You know, how can you write this play about me?" And so there's a certain amount of back and forth.
And there is a funny anecdote that is in the letters too, that the correspondence is, as we found out later, found under her bed, which is about the only place that she would have Shaw be with her, as opposed to on top of it. My understanding is that her daughter achieved the publication of the letters after her death.
But the letters were all found stuffed into a hatbox, crammed under her bed. She was in Paris at the end of her life, and she died just before the Nazis rolled into Paris, and as it says in the play, the English lady who buried her found this hatbox and got out of Paris with it just ahead of the incoming troops.
Oh my goodness.
And got it to her daughter, I guess, in
London. Wow. So this is the third in a series of two-person plays that you've been involved in Collected Works Bookstore.
It's a series that I created almost a year ago at Collected Works. We think of it as a two-hander series, which is the colloquial expression for a two-character play. And yes, Dear Liar is the third. Dorothy Massey likes us to do plays about, quote, towering literary figures, end quote. Thus, Dear Liar is third in the series.
And they are towering letters.
So all of this is happening at Collected Works Bookstore this coming Sunday, the 23rd of January, at 4 in the afternoon. Like all of these events there, they are free and open to the public. And is the book still available?
Yes.
Can people buy the book?
Well, this is the book of all the correspondence edited by Alan Dent, and I absolutely got it online in one of those, shall we say, book finding services for just a couple of dollars, and it is a first edition, so
wow. How
lucky am I to have all of it.
She's flipping this very yellowed book in front of the microphone, ladies and gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, that's what's happening this coming Sunday. Jonathan Richards and Elena Zachary, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks,
thank you,
Mary
Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.